Welcome to Prevention 365 Podcasts. Prevention is every day and every way. This is your host, Carol Almeida, and this is the 39th episode of Prevention 365 from its beginning last year. And this is a special episode because this will be the season finale of Prevention 365. We will cap the first season of the podcast series. And what is more fitting to close the season of Prevention 365 than to have a sit-down conversation with no less than ADAPT's Prevention Director, Jeannie Shimatsu. And for our topic, it will be, how does ADAPT practice prevention through the years? Welcome, Jeannie.
Hi, Carol. Thank you so much for inviting me to be the guest. Yes. I'm excited.
We're so honored, Jeannie. Thank you. Thank you for taking the time. We know how busy you are, but thank you for taking the time. So we'll walk through the past, the present, and the future. So I'd like more to touch on the past. So Jeannie, you have really been considered as the face of prevention here at the Asian American Drug Abuse Program, or what we popularly know as ADAPT. Could you walk us through the evolution of prevention as a strategy to address the issue of substance use, misuse, and abuse?
Well, this is really timely because ADAPT is experiencing a monumental year. This is our 50th anniversary. Mm-hmm. Now, let me make this clear. I have not been with ADAPT for 50 years, but I have been with ADAPT clearly for over 30. Over 30. So I have had the experience of seeing changes over the decades, transitions that were both programmatic and world conditions, you know, conditions of what was happening in our lives. And so prevention definitely had to find its way, and it had to adjust and transition over the decades. I joined ADAPT in the 1980s, in the mid-1980s, and ADAPT, at that time, the entire agency fit in one building, which is what the current therapeutic community, or the TC, is at on 5318 Crenshaw. And it's funny, I was just talking with our executive director, our CEO, Dean Nakanishi, and actually we were talking about this, like, do you remember when your office was there, when I was doing that? And yeah, prevention in the early days was very grassroots. We were about getting out into the schools, after-school programming, working with elementary, middle schools, and much of that was either education-based or alternative programming, and you know, basketball, sports, tutoring, coloring, social activity, social engagement, and then we also started, interestingly enough, through Nancy Reagan's Just Say No, and I know there's a lot of controversy around that because Just Say No in and of itself didn't work. But what it did start, if I had to look at silver lining, is it brought together community groups to ADAPT with ADAPT to start an adult coalition, which is GDAP. And our foundation in the Gardena community has so many layers because in the 70s, that's when ADAPT found its roots and through activism became an agency. It became ADAP. This is where we started providing treatment services. And years later, and several years later, prevention became part of that program, part of the a critical piece. But over the decades, yes, a lot of our prevention work was youth-based, but engaging adult coalitions as sponsors of our youth group, which I think that actually started before me in 1983 with the high school task force. And I joined in 86. But in those years, the idea was to engage high school students as peer educators. So they were trained on substance abuse curriculum, and they went into the schools. And they provided educational sessions to elementary school kids. And part of this was to serve as mentors to them. So the elementary school students could see that these were high school students that were doing things that were changing the community. And by reaching out as educators, that was part of the early role modeling. It's interesting because the South Bay, in particular Gardena, that's where in the 60s and 70s, the late 60s and early 70s, when a rash of overdoses were taking place by young Asian youth. And they were overdosing on reds, which are barbiturates, and a good number of them were women. And so what's interesting about that, in that tragedy, is that you have to go through tragedy to find solutions sometimes. And what wasn't happening was there were no services for Asian and Pacific Islanders at that time. And we recognize, and we clearly recognize, that in all communities of color, services have to be relatable. And so that's partly why Gardena has a special place, because the roots started there. But when we look at the prevention side, those roots also came out of the same need, because substance abuse issues were happening, were continuing in the trend of what was happening in the 80s. And it was the El Camino Lions, inspired by the town hall from Nancy, through Nancy Reagan, that had them reach out to ADAP to say, is there some way we could work together to reach out and work with high school students in our city? Mm-hmm. And with that partnership, GDAP was born, and organizers at that time, prevention specialists, reached out to Gardena High School, and we started our first youth program there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So would you say, Jeannie, that that youth-based organizing actually came or originated or was initiated by, would say, adults?
Well, I think when you talk about the strategies, community organizing is an old strategy for millennia. It just wasn't called that. Mm-hmm. But everything comes out of the community. And in this case, the need was seen that youth needed specific attention around social support, other support, so that it could serve as an alternative to substance use. And the core, when we look at the core of everything, even to this day, it really goes back to communities, community gatherings through coalitions. There really needs to be a strong representation by youth, because there needs to be a foundational development that's going to spur on and pass on through generations. Adults know that. Youth know that.
Yeah.
Once they're engaged, especially.
Yeah. You mentioned about community town hall way back in the past, right? Community town hall. And we still use that, you know, as a strategy in order to outreach and in order as a forum to inform and educate, right? You know, so there, it's an age-old, I would say, age-old tactic, mm-hmm. strategy, but it still is effective. So community, we look at the community as the focal point or as the base of our organizing. Would you agree with that statement, Jeannie?
I fully agree with that. That without the community, we would have no progress, because they are the true experts of where they live. And I think our role is to serve as linkages, liaisons and linkages with the areas of expertise we do know when it comes to certain information. And we come together as partners to build on our strengths, to address what they see as conditions to change, social, environmental, economic. These conditions all contribute to the area of which we battle, which is youth access and youth use of substances. And so our flagship is about that type of prevention. How do we engage communities about these issues that are affecting them in ways that will change the environment to improve wellness, to improve safety, to improve conditions so people can live in a condition that is much better for the lives of themselves, their families, and neighborhoods and communities. I think that's something everyone strives for. Yes. It's not equal, but that's what we strive for in our lives.
Yeah. You know, another point that I'm curious about, Jeannie, is, you know, in the development of the discipline, which is community organizing, in the development of the strategy of community organizing as a strategy, could you walk us through like the development of it as a discipline, as a strategy, you know? I mean, how did we prepare our core? How did we prepare our advocates, our staff, our communities for community organizing?
That's a great question. And if I had to look at the basic steps or cores that we take with our prevention unit, it has to do with some critical pieces: education, information, mobilization, action. And action meaning advocacy, whether the campaign is policy-based, media-based, or other. It's about changing conditions in schools, neighborhoods, homes, parks, public places, the entire community. So these pieces all come together and they don't necessarily work just by themselves. And I think one of those misnomers is, well, let's just educate them and that answers all the questions. Education is a critical piece, but understand that it is a piece to the entire process. Education provides that foundation of understanding of the situation. It connects the dots to what is the issue? Why is that an issue? What is it that we could do? How does it affect you personally? What are you committed to do? How can we bring you and others that are feeling the same way together in a coalition or another gathering? How do we come together? Because numbers, people power, people, it's about people power, people coming together because this is a critical issue. And then joining together with that brain set and figuring out solutions that work because they know their community and they know what needs to change. And sometimes when we look at policy, people back off because they think, oh, it has to be a formal municipal policy. oftentimes those are the best when it does come to prevention, but sometimes the most basic policy, if we use that word loosely, starts in the home. Mm-hmm. And that means taking a look at what's happening in your own home that can make your home a safer place for you and your children or the generations within your family when it comes to things like alcohol. Where do you put it? How do you secure it? Prescription drugs. Don't get into grandma's pills. You know, how do you secure these things so that young people, as young as toddlers, children, don't have access and have accidental overdoses or poisonings? So there's different ways to look at what campaigns are. But campaigns can happen in the home, mm-hmm. in the school, in the neighborhood, in our parks, in our cities. And Carol, you know, you are the expert of policy advocacy. And the one thing we both agree, and in our field, we agree that policy is one of the most successful pieces because it addresses prevention for an entire, you know, an entire swath of area and people.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Jeannie, if I may synthesize, if I may provide synthesis, it's more of, like I say, collecting information, gathering knowledge, not just for knowledge's sake, mm-hmm. or not just to be informed and to be educated about the issue, but we use this body of knowledge in order for us to be motivated to act so that we can bring about change for the better.
Yes, yes, definitely. And one of the frameworks, and I just blanked out, Carol, the strategic prevention framework is a very loose framework that has been adopted by the county, well, technically nationwide, mm-hmm. but is the strategic prevention framework also gives this basic structure, which is assessment, capacity building, planning, implementation, and evaluation. In many ways, if you look at it, that could be applied to almost any area of our life. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Assess, understand what's really happening by gathering that data or that information. Take that information and help that to plan what it is you need to do to make those changes, to establish what the issues are. And the capacity building is, what is it that you need? Who are your partners with that? And implementation is taking that into action. And action is the big piece. You were talking about that. Education and information needs to lead to action. Otherwise, it stays in its own place and it just, you know, it dissipates. Yeah. It has to be associated with a movement, an action, a change.
Yes, change. It's all about movement towards change for the better, right, Jeannie? Yeah. So I would like to emphasize that mantra, Jeannie, that knowledge to action to change.
Yes.
Knowledge to action to change. Precisely. That is supposed to be the mantra for prevention. Yeah.
If you don't mind me asking a question back to you or asking you to share, you have been a pivotal person, actor in this action of policy advocacy. If you had to think back, Carol, which policy piece have you worked on, did you feel had the most impact?
The policy, I would say, would be tobacco prevention and control, particularly the policy with the overarching goal of preventing youth access to tobacco products.
And how have you seen the changes? Like what were some of the concrete changes you saw coming out of some of the policy actions?
Yes, we do have, I mean, you know with Jeannie that we go through the phases and we consciously measure outcomes. You know, we consciously measure outcomes. We have instruments, you know, we have methods like, you know, the young adult purchase survey or then the youth purchase survey. We have pre-policy before the ordinance on tobacco retail licensing ordinance is passed to post-policy adoption. And we see here, you know, the outcomes, you know, of the willingness in terms of the willingness of retailers to sell to youth. You know, before the policy, before the ordinance is passed, you know, we would go out there undercover operations, and we have their employers, or not employers, but retailers, just not being conscious of, you know, of the age of purchase of youth, you know. But with after the ordinance is passed, we go out again with our undercover youth, and we find out that, you know, there is, you know, already that consciousness ingrained, you know, there is already that ingrained consciousness in the retailers that there is already an ordinance, and we have to, you know, and we have to follow and comply with this ordinance. And then you can see when they start asking about age, when they start asking, and they themselves, they also do some education piece to our undercover youth, say, don't you know that this is now the age of legal purchase of tobacco products, you know? And
go ahead, Carol.
Yes, and I think that's how concrete I can go, you know? That's so far our experience. So, I mean, we are evidence-based, you know, and we know. When we say success, we know how to measure success in terms of how close we are to achieving our goal, which is to protect our youth from the harmful consequences of substances like tobacco, alcohol, marijuana, prescription drugs, and other illegal drugs.
You know, it's interesting, Carol, when you shared about that. I think when people think of the sting operations, they think, well, that's such a setup. You know, and it is a method, a legitimate method to figure out what's really happening. Mm-hmm. You know, on conditions of what youth are seeing. And what's interesting outside of that is when we have had conversations with merchants afterwards, because they do get to know who we are at some point. And when we have that conversation, it's interesting because the majority of them do not want to sell. They know. They may not have known the details. So I think some of the information and education shared with them does help to, the knowledge helps to encourage them to maintain what they're doing, which is not to sell. But now they understand why, and they understand the other conditions around that, what that has to do with health and brain development and very critical issues, particularly affecting youth and adolescents. Yeah. So I feel like our work, when we talk about some of the core practices that have led to change, is our role is to help connect the dots. I know that's a very basic statement, but oftentimes we don't take the time to think about what's happening in our lives or what's happening in the conditions around us that could lead to why someone's using. And there's this misnomer that the more information we give about the drug itself will prevent use. Actually, it does not. I think it has to be a combination of helping, whether it's youth, young adults, even adults, have them understand the reason behind the use. So the question might be, yes, now you understand what alcohol may do, but what is the reason why you might have started using in the first place? Mm-hmm. What are some of the conditions in your life that have contributed to using, to trying, to experimenting? You know, and I think initially some people might say, well, it was just there, I was curious. But when you have them dig deeper, for those, especially for those who have continued actively using, there's other reasons. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why much of our efforts with youth work and coalition work has to do with helping to dig deeper so that people connect the dots personally. Then they connect the dots. Oh my gosh, I didn't realize that was happening in my own family. Or that's the reason why so-and-so might have started. So it actually helps from a perspective of compassion too, because we all live, life is not easy. Life is not easy. So these choices we make, particularly during times of stress, can often lead to things that will take us off our rails. And what I mean by that is it could be substance abuse, it could be cutting, it could be depression, which leads to other forms of self-harm. And so when we help people to understand the what's and the whys, and mm-hmm. then we connect them to support, then that becomes part of what preventionists do, is we help that. We help the process to services, to self-acknowledgement, self-understanding, to the understanding that you're ultimately your decisions are your responsibility, but there's a net, a safety net to help you if you need that. And I think this world, especially nowadays, really needs a lot more compassion and support.
Yes. It's multidimensional, Jeannie.
Yes, it is. Yes.
Like, it can start with just the issue of prescription drugs, mm-hmm. or even youth access to tobacco products, but it can open the doors to other social issues like, mental health issues, or even discovery of new diseases, new ailments. Like, for example, we are in a period of pandemic.
Yes.
But it's not just COVID-19 that is the issue with the vaping, but other, other illnesses like E-Valley. I don't know if we've taken this up in one of our discussions, E-Valley, that not only COVID, but young people are affected and are afflicted with E-Valley. This is connected directly to the use of vaping devices. And it's a long disease, much like COVID, So it is multidimensional. And for us really to narrow it down just to, substance use and abuse, you're right. I mean, we have to look at it from a comprehensive mindset. It's a public health. It's a public health issue.
And when it comes to public health, I think it has to be relatable, especially young people. They're not really going to think about or even care about health unless there's something absolutely immediate, and that, I think that applies with adults as well, is unless you turn your body inside out and you can take a look at your lungs or your liver or other things happening, it doesn't, the switch doesn't turn on until you're forced to deal with that health issue. So oftentimes when it comes to what we do in our field, it really goes back to what is currently important for you. What is it? What are the decisions that you want to make for your life, that you have as your life goals? And will making that choice of you getting loaded at a party or driving while high, is that going to derail your plans? Like, have you thought about that connecting the dots to that behavior, to that action, to that outcome.
Yeah, I think there is a challenge to it, Jeannie. We know it, you know, like when we touch on brain development, you know, and substance use.
Yes.
I mean, at the core of our prevention effort is, you know, imparting, especially to the young people and to everyone. I mean, that the impact of substance use on brain development. And brain development does not stop. Brain development continues even up to the age of 26 years. You know, and on top of that, we would say that at the early stage of development of the brain, or referring to the brain of teenagers, of young people, the brain is wired, according to research, the brain is wired that it is still not sensitive to what we call consequences of action.
No.
Yeah, so that presents as a challenge to us. Right, when we go into information and education,
Or it really is about incentivizing their life. And I'm not talking incentivizing that you got a gift card to In-N-Out, which might be nice for that moment, but incentivizing their life. Like, what is it that you really want to do? Are you really gunning to be a basketball player, a professional player? Are you interested in owning your own business, you know, going to school, getting a job? What is it that you really want? And when we can help young people incentivize their own life so that they see that there's some direction and that it's actually panning out, that there's activities that they're introduced that helps lead them to these positive opportunities, a chance to work with someone, a chance to do a project where they get out into the community and they see things that are out of the norm. They get to experience what other people are going through, and there's some level of relatability, or just something as basic as, have you had a chance to voice your own opinion? Mm-hmm. You have your chance to talk about what's important to you and feel like you've been heard and acknowledged. It sounds like such a basic thing, but it's so important. I mean, if it wasn't so if it wasn't true, we wouldn't have these things called influencers.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the movers and shakers on social media. So the idea of being valued and heard has transitioned in different ways, but I think when it comes to our youth populations, everyone needs that. Everyone needs that level of acknowledgement and support so that they could move and find that area of confidence to discover who they are and become who they want to be. But they need that opportunity.
Yes. So, Jeannie, we can now segue to the next question.
Sure.
Now, let's look at the present and let's focus on the present. What are the core practices that illustrate or demonstrate our work in prevention?
Well, I think we did partially talk about that, you know, the continuation, the development of coalitions, policies that we have passed, community-based policies that where we've engaged with coalitions. I think those strategies have proven to be successful and continue to do so. I would say that when you look at what's happening now, much of it was, as you brought up earlier about COVID, for prevention, we had to pivot with that as well. Much of our work prior to COVID was boots on ground, engaging in the community. And for almost a good 2 years, we were stripped of that opportunity because of COVID. And I would say, and I say this with joy, and I say this with a little bit of pride because it came out of community prevention. We pivoted very well when it came to social media. And not everybody had that niche. We had to learn. It was definitely a learning curve, but a couple things came out of it. I would say if I could highlight two, one is Hot Topic Tuesday. One of our clever organizers coined that, and that has now become institutionalized with our team, where educational workshops are provided nearly every Tuesday with varying topics, guest speakers, activities, to highlight substance abuse, but from the perspective of what is happening with current conditions in our lives. Mm-hmm. And so that has been very effective, and that continues to this day. And the other thing is what we're doing now, podcasting. And as you shared earlier, we're in our 39th, which is really, I'm surprised because I was trying to calculate how many have we done? 39, considering we started about a year ago.
Yeah.
And we were brand new to it, green feet, green mic, green everything. And, you know, we had guidance from Jackie, who was our consultant, and she gave us ideas on how to podcast. And the rest of that, I think that was taken on with eagerness by the community prevention team, then with ADAP's admin, and now is spreading to other units within our ADAP family, our Ohana. So podcasting became our way of reaching out to many people about varying issues, from recovery, stories of recovery, understanding substance abuse from personal testimony, understanding prevention from things like appreciating love, stories from the homeland, experiences being multi-ethnic, and, you know, varying topics all in between. So I would say, if you talked about what is happening currently, I would say that was one of our successes during this period of pandemic. And now that we've merged, there's a hybrid of in-person activities where we're reaching out, we're continuing to survey, educate, and promote. Prevention is back on track. I do have to say, though, and I want to give a shout out to both our prevention team, the HIP team, and IYCC, that continue to provide direct services to clients, to the unhoused populations. They never stopped. They were boots on ground through the entire period of COVID. So as essential workers, our hats go off to them, and we want to acknowledge HIP and IYCC for that. So that is part of who we are as prevention. And the umbrella of dynamics and of program reach is really extensive. So I'd say, in a nutshell, that's what we are now.
Mm-hmm. And when you say HIP team, that will be the health intervention program.
Yes.
And it's mostly focused on what's called harm reduction strategies.
Harm reduction, which includes needle exchange, it includes HIV, it includes other aspects related to the conditions around use and to reduce use through harm reduction strategies. It also includes includes housing for those who are experiencing homelessness.
Yeah.
So it has its umbrella of services and a definite need for those who are on the streets. We really have to respect that that situation has not improved, if anything, and not by the work, but by the condition of COVID. It has made the living conditions much harder.
Yeah.
So hats off to our outreach health educator.
Yes. And on the other hand, IYCC is in the Chinese Youth Community Center. And what is unique about this program is that they cater or they provide services to what we call the marginalized sectors, especially what we term as the hard to reach sector brought about by social issues like illegal immigration, English proficiency. Is that correct, Jeannie?
Well, so IYCC specifically targets the Southeast Asian community of the South Bay. So their outreach goes to the Khmer population as well as the Vietnamese population. And so it supports needs that include job training, job placement, or linkages to food issues, making sure that they're provided with the type of needs that service the basics, you know, housing, food, jobs. And it's interesting because coming out of conditions of war, and it may be a generation or two that this has happened, the impact of generational trauma where they've had to escape with their lives. They've lost family members, starting over. There are so many layers to that that still exist, even with second generation and incoming third generation. But primarily it's the 1.5 to 2 second generation that are helping to lift their communities now. Working with, as you said, language, service access that is ethnically supported. And so there's so many issues layered with that. And when we talk about substance abuse, there are influences just within that experience that contribute to use, various use. And so IYCC does a great job reaching to the underserved pockets to make sure that they are supported.
Yeah. Well said, Jeannie. And I would say well synthesized. That would really show our audience how prevention is actually morphed into something bigger and has really expanded to address the multidimensional social issues, not just substance use and abuse. Jeannie, I'm curious about, and I would like to ask you your analysis and your perspective about this, going back to the past and going back to how prevention has evolved. You know, you mentioned very strongly and emphatically, it's school-based, you know, it's school-based, youth-based. So we find our youth in school and then we organize, we nurture them and we cultivate relationships. But it would seem like the present, especially now that we're coming post-surge, you know, post-surge and schools are just reopening, we're faced with the challenge of recruitment and much more retention. So, I mean, honestly speaking, our organizers are saying that, you know, our youths have graduated and we're faced now with the challenge of how do we bring in the youth so much so that we can at least equal the experience we've had in the early days of prevention work?
I think we could learn from the past of some examples of what worked then, but I think the key thing is to pivot and adjust to what is happening now. Because it's one thing to do the glory days.
Yeah.
And it's another thing to capitalize on the certain aspects that were successful that could be applied now. And so some of those things that, particularly because of COVID, it has created a gap, a chasm in social engagement. I think the youth want it, they crave it, they miss it. Some youth don't know that it's 2 years is a long time.
Yeah.
And it's a sacrifice for many who looked forward to these traditions such as graduation or parties or, you know, just the normal social things that Carol, you and I did and the organizers did when they were younger, were denied to this generation.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that the extra steps would be building trust. Honestly, I think that's gonna, we have to take a few steps back. That's just that reality, is that we can't just come in and expect that we can recruit like we used to, and the youth are gonna flood back. Like, we're gonna have to approach it a little differently. And part of that would be engaging in some conversation about it, finding out what they're willing to do. Also finding out, engaging in a relationship, so at least some of them might be willing to come out and try it out. Also working, now this also, these strategies we've done before, but maybe with a different hand, a different attitude, and a slightly different approach in how we message it. But working with, collectively with key school leaders, faculty, administrators, but also finding the young leaders themselves, getting the engaging with them to find out what is it that you've been hearing and what would you recommend? And I think starting from ground level and taking that humble approach of, we have to take the extra steps and start over and do that footwork. I think that's the only way to gain ground again, because that trust will create a group and will grow the group, because then they know that the dedication is about them. It's for them, it's for their development, but it's for their ownership.
Yes.
So there's several steps, but I think we have to take a couple steps back to move forward.
Yes. One, the step backward can make two steps forward.
I think it's allowing for the pause to listen.
Yeah.
And allowing the pause to take in and coming up with strategies that are tweaked to best fit what's happening now.
Yeah, but Jeannie, would you say that we do have to go back, right? We have to go back, immerse ourselves in our communities, right?
Yeah. And I think that's what's happening. And if anything, I would issue patience. Patience to allow the organic development of coming together, to allow for that trust to build, to provide and to incentivize in a way where they see it's worthwhile investing their time and energy to become part of this group. And I think we have some members that could be, that are currently still engaged, that could serve as part of that outreach. But I think a lot of that footwork will be to get back on campus.
Yes, and also the realization that organizing is a painstaking effort. It's a painstaking effort, you know. And it's not only patience, Jeannie, but persistence.
Yes.
Persistence, yeah.
Persistence,
yeah. It's a painstaking effort, yeah.
A lot of P's, painstaking, persistent.
Yeah.
Annie.
Yeah, that's right. So the third would be looking at the future, Jeannie. So being at the helm, I would say, being at the helm of the prevention program at ADAP, what do you see are the directions
future? I think right now I'm still absorbing some of the changes that or expectations from the role I have as director. And so I'm always allowing for the pause to listen. But there are a few things that I would like to see moving forward that I think are not too different from what I did as a coordinator, but from a more expanded and from a more expanded perspective and approach. And one is to promote internal leadership development. I think there's this expectation that, or a understanding that a person can be a leader if they have the title. Well, I need to be the coordinator. I need to be the director. Honestly, a title is a title. Mm-hmm. I think what creates the leader is what you bring to your position, and there's leadership at every level. And the idea is to prepare everyone for their current position, but their next step. And the leadership is about developing the confidence, not just in the field and as a role, in this case as organizer or outreach educator or counselor, but how do you build your skills and your confidence to take it to that next level? It shouldn't be dedicated just to a person with a title. It's about how you do this for yourself, regardless of your title. So that's one area that I want to see progress. Mm-hmm. The other area would be, we talked about this earlier about the pulse of the community. I really feel like with COVID and also with conditions that are happening in politics today that are affecting our daily lives, I mean, the Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe versus Wade is a long battle. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is that we're looking at not just the overturning of something that I had thought was constitutional, and I still believe is, that, you know, the right for a woman to decide for themselves. But I think there's such a focus on abortion, and what's the undercurrent of that when we talk about connecting the dots is really about, it has to do with woman's health, yeah, reproductive health, overall health. All of these things are being compromised now, mm-hmm, especially for women of color, especially by women that are economically disadvantaged. So all the more, and how does this tie into what we do? All the more our generation, all the more reason why we have to invest even more in our generation of young girls and women, because they're going to have to refight a battle for themselves, for their lives.
Yeah. As they said, the struggle continues.
The struggle never ended. The struggle
continues. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And we go back again to, it's not just substance use abuse. It's not just abortion rights, you know, but the issue is multidimensional.
Yes.
It's multidimensional. And I think it was Terry Reynolds, our HIP team coordinator, that I also guested to talk about homelessness. And that was last year in one of our episodes. And she says that oftentimes homelessness is equated with substance use, abuse, as well as mental health issues. And she proceeded to say that those are myths. Yes. Those are myths. Homelessness affects different social backgrounds, different classes. It's multidimensional.
Yes.
So it's the same, you know, we have to, it's not just, you know, getting involved with substance use, but we also have to get involved with Roe versus Wade, with women's reproductive rights, you know, with the with the public health issues.
Yes.
Public health issues. Okay. So, Jeannie, one last, I would say one last question. So, can you coin an aspirational goal? At this point,
I would say, you know, off the top of my head, it would be do what is right and do it with a dedicated heart, because it's about what we can give and what we could do, not only for ourselves, but to change the life of others.
Well said, Jeannie. Well said. And that, I think, is the essence of social change. You know, it's changing the lives of people for the better.
Sorry, of course.
Thank you so much, Jeannie.
Thank you, Carol. This was an interesting conversation. I appreciate that.
Yes. And this is a teachable, shall we say, an educational piece, actually. We know that we have, shall we say, retreats, you know, staff retreats, staff training. And I think I would recommend this episode to be part of staff retreat and staff training. You know, so this will, you know, kind of provide an overview. This will provide an inspiration and a motivation. Remember, knowledge, information, education. I mean, they just don't matter, not unless we put them
into
action.
Yes.
Because it is only in putting them into action that we can bring about change. And in putting them into action, there is definitely a need for motivation. And this episode, the season finale of Prevention 365, can bring about motivation for a lot of people, for a lot of us. Thank you so much, Jeannie.
Carol, thank you. I appreciate this opportunity. Thank you. Thank you.
Yes. And so we bring to a close momentarily. And what I mean to a close, it's the season finale of Prevention 365. So stay tuned. We'll be back with bigger, better, more inspiring stories of human struggles, human connectivity, and most of all, the urge, the desire to change for the better. So, to all of our listeners, to our audience, on the Believe Network, Apple, Spotify, and ADAP YouTube channel, it is bye for now from the Prevention 365 podcast team. Thank you.